within the trails we ride.
You're listening to the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick is a horseman, trainer, international clinician, and author who helps empower horse people from all over the world with the skills, knowledge, and mindsets needed to create trusting partnerships with their horses. Warwick offers a free 7-day trial to his comprehensive online video library that includes hundreds of full-length training videos and several home study courses at videos.warwickschiller.com. Just because you see
what it shows. G'day everyone, welcome back to the Journey On podcast. I'm your host Warwick Schiller, and my special guest this week is a lovely lady from Canada named Carmen Theobald. Carmen has a great story. You know, these days she runs a thing called Horse Sense North, which tries to empower people through coaching, speaking workshops, combined with some horse sense. So they work on personal growth, leadership and team development, and trauma recovery. And Carmen is one of those people who is in the healing space because of her lived experience. And I don't want to define her by this, but one of the major things in Carmen's life was she's the survivor shooting, which unfortunately is more and more prevalent these days. And that played a huge part in her, you know, deciding to look at the world a certain way and to go into the healing arts. So she has a great story, a lot of great stories actually. But the thing I loved about talking with Carmen is she's like an old soul. She had some innate old wisdom about her and a way of communicating ideas that I just thought was quite frankly mesmerizing. So anyway, I hope you guys enjoy this conversation with the amazing Carmen Theobald as much as I did. Carmen Theobald, welcome to the Journey On podcast.
Thank you so much, Warwick. It's a pleasure to be here.
Hey, it's a pleasure to have you. So you're in Ontario, Canada right now?
That's correct.
That's where you live?
That's where I live. It's not where I grew up, but it's where I live and I love it here.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Montreal, Quebec. I grew up right in the city, and it was a wonderful place to grow up for lots of reasons, and I'm so happy not to be in the city anymore.
Yeah, well, you've made quite the journey from growing up in this. You're a farrier, you're a coach, you're a facilitator of transformational stuff to do with horses, and a self-defense coach. You've got a lot on your resume there. So what I want to unpack is your journey to what you're doing now, and I may have just skipped over stuff. So what exactly do you do these days? And then I want to work backwards from there.
Sure. So I guess the simplest form of what I do is saying that I'm the founder and director of Horse Sense North, and we really focus on empowerment through embodied and healing experiences with horses. So some of that's talking about horses with some kind of horse sense, and sometimes it's actually in person with them. So we do a lot of work with first responders. We do a lot of work with individuals and groups, some teams, but it's really focusing on helping people come perhaps out of a dark place and into a better place in their life where they feel like they're not as stuck, they have more options. And the horses are just the most phenomenal teachers of that, as I think you and a lot of your listeners.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you did, but you said something there that made me think of quite a bit of stuff, somatic sort of thing, getting people back into their bodies. Is that a large part of it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I don't think we can do the healing journey and really step into who we're meant to become if we're not learning to get into our bodies or back into our bodies.
Mm. Yeah, I've been kind of on about that for a while as far as getting back to our hunter-gatherer roots or whatever and regaining maybe some of the senses that we, you know, got drummed out of us by society and culture sort of thing. And, you know, those senses are all pretty much somatic. They all come from the body. So let's unravel. How did you get to this point? So you grew up in Quebec?
Yes, I grew up in Montreal. Quebec's technically correct, but a lot of people hearing that, they'd say, well, Montreal's like a whole other world, and it kind of is. It's an island, and it has its own culture and its own flavor and its own languages and everything about it. So, from Montreal.
Okay. And where did your life take a turn? Like, you know, what were you into when you were a kid, and how did you take a turn from being a girl growing up in a city to, you know, now you're a farrier, among a lot of other things. So let's go there. How did you get out of the city girl into the horsey stuff?
Sure. So what I was into as a kid, you know, starting that far back, lots of things and not enough. I think there was a lot of me that was really scared to show up in the world. There was a lot of me that was doing my best to be good, right? To get good grades, to do all the things, to get approval, to even if I, you know, pushed back on some stuff, ultimately there was a lot of me that was holding back and kind of holding myself in. But I was starting to find things that really felt true and right. And one of the things that has always felt true and right were animals. So I actually wanted to be a veterinarian for a very long time. And when I got to the end of high school, we kind of had to decide, are we going into the more intensive sciences that last year? Am I continuing down that route? And I had the grades, I had everything I needed. And I had this panic attack of like, I can't do this. I felt trapped. I felt like I was going to spend the next 10 years of my life in a cage. And it's not that I think of education or schooling that way, but it was that sense of like being boxed in, and I couldn't handle it. So I switched out of all the things and went into Spanish and drama instead, and let my dreams of being with animals go. And then I ended up finding a tremendous amount of enjoyment of finding ways to serve others. And that led me to study social services at Dawson College. And I loved it. I really did. I loved the teachers. I loved the internship that I was able to have working at a youth center. It felt so good to be giving back. And then when I was there, there was a really traumatic event that took place while I was at college that changed everything in my life.
We're going to get to that here in a second because I kind of know a little bit about that. But I kind of want to unravel, do you have a sense of why you were drawn to, you know, like the social services sort of thing? You know, a lot of times people say who get into studying psychology and stuff, sometimes they've had some therapy and realized, you know, they've had some things they want to work on, had some therapy and realized, oh, I want to share this with the rest of the world. I want to help people like I've been helped. Did yours come from that angle, or you just had that wanting to help other people gene?
It's probably all of the above. I think growing up, there was a lot of really wonderful stuff, and there was a lot of very, very hard stuff too. And I think that made me very attuned to people struggling, to the sense of not feeling seen, not feeling heard, not feeling safe. And so the thought and the experience of supporting people into a safer feeling in whatever way that was going to be just felt really important, because I knew how important it was for me to have moments of that. I didn't have a therapist who got me to that point, but I had people here and there and moments here and there, little glimmers here and there of people who really helped me feel seen and safe and heard. So that that was something that I wanted to give back in doing. And I think I also just want to be part of a better world. You know, it's a pretty messed up place that we're living in, and it was a way for me to be able to give back.
So tell me about your internships. You were working with like at-risk youth, were they? What was the story there?
Oh, so it's this wonderful place in Montreal that still exists. The location is different now. It's called Head in Hands. And they're a youth center. I could even be getting the language a little bit wrong on that, but they just have such a variety of programs and free services that they offer. So I had a chance to, you know, work at the front desk and kind of do some triaging. I was able to, because I was part of the social services program, they're trying to help me get a well-rounded experience there. I was able to go and spend time with the young moms and go and spend time with the street workers and go and spend time with all kinds of different programs that they were offering for youth, which was, I believe, 14 to 25, but I could be wrong on that. So if anyone's interested in the organization, don't take my word for it. But it was just wonderful to have that chance to really be deeply in that world that I could so deeply relate to myself.
So like with the young mums and the street workers, were they coming to you or were you going out to them?
Both people would come into Head and Hands. They would go out to speak to people. I didn't actually go out on the street with street workers, but I had a chance to really connect with them in the organization itself. I don't know all the programs that they have now, but they had tons of resources. They have a clinic there, you know, nurse practitioner led clinic. They offer tons of, just supports for every single area of life that youth are potentially not only struggling with, but wanting to find more joy in. And so there was a lot of joy and a lot of creation of connection. And as I know some of your previous guests have spoken about, I think that need for safety and connection are so massive in life. And it's just wonderful to be around people who do that and who are passionate about finding ways to give that to others.
You know, when you are working in something like that, you know, we're talking about connection and safety, especially the safety part I want to get at here. You know, there is, if you're working with young mums or whatever, and, you know, they might be in a situation at home or in their domestic relationship to where there's some, a feeling of unsafety there, but it's a quantifiable feeling of unsafety because you know this person and you know what they're capable of, you know their triggers and all that sort of stuff, but it's got to be a totally different animal for the street workers. I mean, that has got to be, I would imagine that there is very little sense of safety. Is that, did they share any of those sorts of things with you when you're helping them out?
Yes. And it's also not my world, so I don't want to like speak too much to it because I don't want to misrepresent. Yeah. But I think what you're saying is really true in that the forms of safety that we may experience can look and feel and sound really different no matter what walk of life we're coming from. And honestly, I think sometimes the sense of not being safe with people that we also should trust and do know really well in some ways is more insidious because it really erodes our ability to trust ourselves. I mean, you have an experience with someone that you don't know that causes harm or has a violent ending or experience or something like that. Or even if it's not so overt, right? It's just a subtlety of like, I don't feel right with this person or whatever it might be. Okay, now we can like have this moment where we're more likely to actually trust ourselves in some ways if it's just with people who we're not also supposed to have a role with. But when it's people who are supposed to have a role in our life that are supposed to be safe according to whatever positions or titles or how society views it, but they're not, and then we start to second guess ourselves. We start to second guess our body. We're starting to second guess what really feels true and right to us. So no matter what we're talking about, I think that safety piece is huge in everything we're doing all over the place. And how can then we create more of a sense of safety within ourselves to start to trust our body again?
Mm. You also mentioned you worked the front desk sort of as a triage thing. So would you have people come through the front door I imagine, varying states of distress?
Sometimes, but what I loved about this organization, it's really fun that we're talking about this because I don't get a chance to chat about them much, but it was really meaningful to spend that time with them. It was really put together as like a community space. So yeah, they had supports for people who showed up in distress, and sometimes they would walk through the door that way. Absolutely. But a lot of time people would just come in to say hi and have a space where they could grab some free condoms or grab, you know, some support or have a free meal or like, you know, connect with someone who could then connect them to something else. Or there was just creating a lot of trust. So it wasn't like people had to feel like they were at their wit's end to get support.
That's very cool. That's a tribe. That's like a safe space you can go to before you're at your wit's end. That's almost like the family they probably didn't have.
For some, I'm sure it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's probably why I felt like it was so great, because I didn't have that kind of sense of safety in my own house. So having it at other places, whether it was at Head and Hands or whether it was at a friend's house or whether it was wherever, studying social services, right? All these different places where I felt that sense of safety, that like this is where I could really show up. More of myself was safe to show up, and that was really welcomed, and there was just a different energy, and I didn't have to be at my wit's end to push for me to be heard on the things that might have been really important. Like, that's such a gift.
And so during your time there, these interns while you were still at college? Internship, sorry.
Yeah, so it's in Quebec, it's called a stage. And I was doing that during my time in social services. That's correct.
Okay, so then before you mentioned there was a rather traumatic event that happened while you were at college. Can you share a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So I was actually in this amazing class that I loved. It was a 6-hour class, which sounds terribly long, but it always flew by for me. And it was precisely on time every single day. It went from 9 to noon, and then from noon to 1 was lunch, and then 1 to 4 was the second 3 hours, the second half. And when I mean on time,
let me guess, you like precisely on time, do you? You're a precisely on time person?
Well, sometimes, but or I try to be. But why this is important is because this day, it was the only day that we were not on time. It was the only day that we had these presentations that we could decide to either go to lunch early, 10 minutes early, or go to lunch 20 minutes late and squeeze in one more half hour presentation. And as a class, we voted to go to lunch 20 minutes late. And when I left the classroom, I opened my phone and I had a really high number of missed calls, and I was listening to a frantic voicemail from a friend trying to make out what he was saying. And then this person comes rushing around the corner, pale as a ghost, and orders us to get back into our class. And I heard some distant noises and distant screams, and I didn't really know what was going on until all at once it made sense. And I realized that we were in the middle of a school shooting. So I went back into the class, and my classmates and I hid under desks in the back corner of the room for the next 45 minutes, listening as the shooter got closer and closer to where we were. And honestly, I really believed I was going to die. And when I didn't, when police officers came in and silently escorted us to a position of safety, and I got outside and I felt the sunshine on my face, and the reality started to really sink in that I was alive, everything changed. Not instantly, but in that moment, absolutely everything changed and continued to progress since then. And I think what it gave me, without trying to put a positive spin on the experience, because it's a total atrocity, and I would never say that I'm glad it happened ever. And I'm going to do my best to, first of all, be honest about what my experience was, and also learn from it. And what that learning was is that life can be so short, and it gave me the courage to start to really live it for myself.
What was the 45 minutes like? Like, what was going through your mind in the 45 minutes? Were there regrets for things left unsaid, deeds left undone? I mean, I'm just guessing. I have no idea what would be going through your head. But what was going through your head for that 45 minutes?
Well, there was like two parts of it for me. The first part of the 45 minutes, which was, it felt longer, but I think it was actually shorter, was very, very high in fear. Trying to call people that I loved. The cell towers had gone down because everyone was trying to contact their loved ones and everything stopped communication-wise. I was with a couple of my friends in the class at the time, and we were sitting together and holding hands, and my other classmates, some of them, you know, we all have our different trauma responses. Some people were sobbing, some people were trying to not make noise in their moment of panic. Some people were frozen, and I could feel the panic in me continuing to rise. And then it's almost as though I had two options in front of me. And one was that I continued to get more and more afraid and leading me down to feeling like I was totally paralyzed. And the other option was to come to this place of acceptance with it. And I honestly came to this place of this, I believe, could be my end. I didn't know for sure, but I was like, yep, there's a really solid chance that this is the last day. And I just allowed myself to lean into that. And I don't know how I got to it. It wasn't a fully conscious decision or anything like that. It was just kind of, I think it just felt better than the alternative. And I allowed myself to sit with that. And I started to take deeper breaths. And I started to, what I now know was, do a lot of self-regulation. And that really supported my two friends who were with me because they were starting to go into really high states of panic. And it helped them co-regulate. And it was almost like floating, but not in this, like I've been in a really, really scared place where I've been a little bit disembodied before. But that's not what this was. This was more of a deeply in my body, but kind of a lightness despite all the heaviness around me.
Yeah, that, you know, you don't know until you're in that situation, but I've always thought I would be a freezer. You know, I've had quite the freeze response, and I always thought I would be a freezer. And a number of years ago, I've talked about a little bit on the podcast, but I was in a situation to where I thought someone was going to pull a gun on me. And as the guy's hand reached into his waistband, I kind of had a peace come over me. Maybe it's a little similar to yours. Like I was kind of like, So now I know. I've always wondered. That was kind of, you know, this is how it ends. And I wasn't kind of outside my body, but I was almost watching, you know, I was almost watching myself think, So this is interesting. This is how it ends. And wondering, who the hell am I thinking like that? It was interesting. So then the first responders showed up, and did they lead you away from there while the shooter was still active?
I believe I still heard shots in the background. Now, if someone actually did a timeline, I don't know how accurate my memory would be,
right?
But it sure sounded like in my memory that yes, there was still active shooting happening, and I know that we were instructed to be extremely quiet as we were leaving, and we went down this back staircase, and so I'm quite sure, but I can't say 100%.
And so that was kind of a turning point for you. How did your Can you kind of lead us through, because you said it wasn't all at once, but can you lead us through, you know, it's almost like they talk about people who experience something similar to where you were pretty sure you were going to die, and then when you don't, it's almost like you're born again, like you get a new a new start. So what was your journey like from there on out? What was the probably the first thing that changed, or the first major difference you noticed?
That's a great way to put it. I learning about post-traumatic growth, it feels the most true to that and to what I went through. What it looked like was starting to loosen the cage that I had put myself in, where I have felt so many inner confinements that were extremely subtle all the way to life choices. And said, it's like someone gave me the key to go, actually, you always had the key and you're not actually locked in this cage in the way that you thought you were. And so that let me say yes to things that I would have absolutely said no to before this experience. For example, this is a big one. My then friend, now husband, asked if I wanted to quit school with him and go traveling across Canada and work on a farm in exchange for room and board. Actually, we didn't know about the in exchange for room and board part. He just said, let's go across Canada, experience nature, maybe go to a farm or something. I was like, he asked me that, and he was serious, but he wasn't expecting me to say yes. But he's the kind of person that if I did say yes, he was all in. So I knew it was a real ask, but he wasn't expecting anything. And he asked the question, and I sat with it and said nothing. And it was like, why the hell not? Okay. And I would have never quit school before. You know, education and getting a degree or a diploma or something was like super important to me. But not necessarily the true me. The part of me that felt like I had to, the part of me that it felt like I had to meet the pressures and expectations of what society felt like my life should look like and be like. And although, yes, I do deeply value learning and education, that doesn't necessarily mean it has to apply to what my life journey is. So when he said that, it was, and we had been talking already about nature and feeling really unhealthy in the city for lots of reasons, aside from this horrific event. So just my ability to actually say yes and do something that I thought I would never do. I would have never even considered it. Had someone asked me to quit school before, I would have laughed and said, yeah, good try. No, never happening. Right. But what I was able to realize is that, just like that panic moment that I had about going into veterinary school, feeling like I was being caged in for the next 10 years, that's still how I felt, even if it was in a shorter or different program, that being within these walls of a classroom and within the walls of my family home was something that I absolutely needed to break free from. And maybe that would land me back in school, maybe it wouldn't, but I needed a massive life change. I needed to feel like my life was my own. And this gave me that courage and that clarity to start living that way.
How long after the traumatic event did he ask you to do that?
About 6 or 7 months.
Oh, okay. So that was, I wanted to get the timeline there. Mm-hmm. So you were still at school?
I was still at school.
Okay. So that the question I have for you, how was it going back to school the next time you went back there, whether it was the next day or the next week? How was that experience?
Yeah. I was extremely lucky to be in the social services program with this event taking place. And I think, I know I can give the amazing staff and teachers a tremendous amount of credit that I'm not walking around with debilitating post-traumatic stress, that I actually was able to continue walking into post-traumatic growth because of their immediate debriefing support, ways that we talked about it as a class, ways that we learned through the experience, felt supported, felt seen. They just did a phenomenal job. And not to say that that's enough for everyone and everyone's experience is different. And if other people needed different kinds of supports or therapy, that's completely understandable. For me, I think it was because of where I was at in myself that was enough for me to keep moving forward in a healthy way. I just feel awful for a lot of the other students and teachers who did not have that kind of skill set, who did not have that kind of support. A lot of teachers were told, okay, you have to help your students through this. And I know many, many people in school at the time who went back to class, their teacher said, you're good? We're good? Okay, moving on. Because they didn't have the skill. They didn't have the knowledge of how to move through that themselves, never mind help their students. So I was extremely fortunate to be in that kind of environment. Walking back in, that first moment of actually walking back in, felt like a lot and very good to be all together. We, as a college, many, many, many people, we all waited to walk in collectively together. And there was something very empowering about kind of taking back the school together.
You've mentioned a phrase several times that I hadn't actually heard before. We've all heard of post-traumatic stress, but you have mentioned post-traumatic growth. Sounds like that's a thing. Do you want to talk to us a bit about that?
Yes, it is definitely a thing. And of course, right now I am blanking on who actually coined the term, but it is an official term and there's a bunch of research about it from multiple different sources. And I'm not a therapist, I'm not a clinician, but I will say that my understanding of it is that it's allowing these traumatic experiences that people have where they get to a place at some point, or it might be right away, it depends on the circumstances, where instead of pulling them into this very dark place, it actually is the catalyst to a tremendous amount of healthy growth in their life. Not that the trauma is healthy, not that the experience is good, but that it was able to become this big tipping point in their life to go into the next chapter.
I've just done a bit of a Google search on post-traumatic growth, and Wikipedia says the history of it, the general understanding that suffering and distress can potentially yield positive changes thousands of years old. For example, some of the early ideas and writings of the ancient Hebrews, Greeks, and early Christians, as well as some of the teachings of Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, and the Baha'i faith contain elements of the potentially transformative power of suffering. Says the term post-traumatic growth was coined by a psychologist at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. Doesn't say when, though.
Thank you for that.
It's all right. I got Google at my fingertips here. I'd never actually heard that term before. So was the trip across country, was that like the first major change after the event, or were there some others in there as well?
There were others, but I think much more subtle. So that was the first big life decision that this experience allowed me to start to make. But little subtle ways of just saying no to something that I would have said yes to, maybe going out for, going out to a bar that in the past I would have said yes to go out with friends. And that moment I was like, it's actually not what I want. It's actually not what I want to do. So I started to have more ability to listen to what my true self was saying on the inside.
Am I guessing that you were actually a closet introvert, but you had to go along with what everybody was doing?
Oh, absolutely. And I don't know, I think maybe I'm one of those people who's kind of got both sides. I have a lot of extroverted qualities when I need them and want them, but I guess I'm learning more about introversion and I'm thinking, well, no, that maybe still fits, because when I need to bring it up and I can have really good ability to use my social skills, it's not to say introverts don't have good social skills, sometimes better. But yeah, I think you nailed it, Warwick. It's probably super introverted, and because I was looking to have some kind of sense of being worthy, being accepted, trying to fit in, I would say yes to doing a lot of things that I didn't actually feel aligned with.
Mm. So tell us about your trip across Canada. Where did you guys go to?
So we ended up finding this program called Woofing. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's Worldwide Opportunities on Organic Farms. And you can sign up for any country and you get a whole list of farms that are willing to take you in as a host. And then you go there and volunteer in exchange for room and board. And I really liked this because it's not like you had to make some commitment as to a bigger organization that's organizing everything. You're really in control as the person who's going along. I thought I was going to be going to multiple farms and make my way out to BC. We were both intending to do that. We weren't sure if we're going to go all the way together or not, but we're like, let's start out and see how things go. And we ended up going to this first farm in Ontario, about an hour from where I am right now. We thought we were going to be there for 2 weeks, and we were there for almost 2 years.
So you didn't get to BC, I take it.
I did not get to BC. I did not. And that is okay.
So if you guys listening who may not have great geography skills about Canada, Ontario is on the eastern side of it and BC is on the Pacific Ocean side. So it's a big country, you know, it's the same width as the United States, of course, because it sits on top of it, which is roughly the same width as Australia. So if you guys are in Australia, they basically left New South Wales and were heading towards Western Australia, but didn't get very far.
And if you're in Europe, Aussie translation, this is great.
And if you're in Europe, you're in Eastern Europe and you're heading towards France, but you didn't even get across the border to the next country. And so you spent 2 years there. What was the farm? What did they grow?
So the farm had organic vegetable gardens, maple syrup production. And the real reason I wanted to be there and could never leave is 24 horses.
Mm.
So they had a lot of young horses at the time. And the owner of the farm was quite overwhelmed and burnt out. And it was mostly people like myself who were handling the young horses or all of the horses. And just like myself, most of us knew nothing about them. So the horses were to be, to put it softly, not easy. They and of no fault of their own, right? No fault of their own. Yeah. They're trying to seek some sense of safety, just like we are as humans. And people like myself were not able to give it to them because we didn't know what we were doing. I didn't know what I was doing. I had a handful of horse experience going on a couple of trail rides, this and that. But I really knew nothing about them. And it was kind of like trial by fire and a serious school of hard knocks. But I was so determined to keep learning about them. Like, I remember that first night where I went down to the barn and I had shown up and I was so excited to be there. And I was just waiting for the first moment someone would ask me to do something near the horses. And so the owner, her name is Holly. She's a good friend of mine still. She invited me to come down to the barn and feed the horses with her. And of course, I wasn't helpful. I was just standing there. And this big farm, they had, all these horses in these stalls around me. I was in the middle of the barn and it was like surround sound horse chewing. And it's like something shifted in my cells and I was completely enamored and I couldn't imagine my life without them ever again. But it was also really hard and dangerous, honestly. I had my shoulder dislocated at one point because the horse had this big move that I didn't know how to handle. And that was another one of these moments that I think connects back to the experiences we're talking about. I had all the blood drain out of my face and it was very painful. And it was this moment early on at my time at the farm where I could have gone, I love horses, but I'm also terrified of them. And I don't know if I can do this. Or I love horses and I'm terrified of them. So I better learn as much as I possibly can so I don't have to be anymore. And I'm so glad that's the route I chose.
You know, it's funny you put it that way. So we just came back from the second annual Journey on Podcast Summit that we had in San Antonio, Texas, and I had my son do a talk this year. Had my wife and my son both do a talk this year, and he lives in Hawaii and has a pretty adventurous life, but his talk was on there's two types of people in the world. There's yes people and there's no people, but then when you get to the yes people, there's two types of yes people. There's yes and people and yes but people. And he has got an education in yes and, because he lives with and hangs out with a whole bunch of yes and people. So, you know, like one of the presentations, he said, you know, like, do you want to go to the baseball game? Yes, but we need to leave early to miss the crowd. Or the other person says, yes, and we can get ice cream on the way home. You know, it's like, yes, and yes, but. And you just had a yes. You just had a moment where you could have been a yes, but you chose to be a yes, and. And it seems like the yes, and people lead a bit of a different life. So where did you, you were there for a couple of years. What was the next step in your journey to becoming all of the things that are listed on your bio right now? Because we still haven't really got to the starting of any of them, apart from your social services background that, you do transformational growth experiences. What was the next step from there?
So while I was working at this farm, honestly getting my ass kicked by these horses on the regular, I was having these moments where I would be holding horses for the farrier who would come. Mm. And I was asked to actually do some training, and I'll put that, you know, in quotes, with this one young horse named Contessa. And Contessa was and is an incredibly feisty, bold, brave, beautiful being who really enjoys challenging all the horses and people around her for a little bit of fun. And she was 2 years old at the time. And I was asked to do some work with her because it was obvious that she didn't totally hate me. When she really didn't like someone, she made it very clear. So looking back, that was like a terrible, terrible idea. But I'm so glad that I said yes, even though I knew nothing. And so Contessa kept kind of stretching me to learn more. And one of my jobs with her was basically to help her get safer for the farrier. So this person coming in to take care of horses' hooves. And it was terrible for him. I mean, he was on the verge of getting very seriously injured every time he was trimming her. And so I was never really working with her feet. I was just doing stuff with her to increase her sense of connection with me and ultimately her sense of safety, because some of it was humorous and some of it was her as a young horse going like, who's actually going to be helping me feel like I don't have to be in charge. And so I don't think.
Bingo.
Yeah.
Right there, without knowing it, that is the thing, you know, all the challenges horses present us are not them being, you know, they're not challenging us. They're trying to figure out, am I safe? You know,
exactly. Like,
if you think about it as, so I had a podcast guest named Emily Kaysdotter, and Emily's from Sweden, and she, have you heard that podcast yet?
I haven't, but I'll have to look it up now.
Oh my goodness. So Emily is a lot of things. But one of the things she is I would loosely call her an animal communicator. But she's not an animal communicator that says, your horse is sending me a picture of a red box or something like that. She's almost like a shapeshifter. She can inhabit the consciousness of animals. And she also gets downloads from the collective consciousness of groups of animals, like the collective consciousness of horses or whatever. And she says that, you know, that we were always taught there's a hierarchy in horse herds or whatever. But basically when there's conflict, it's conflict over, well she said, you know, in a herd of horses, the horse who's best suited for the job does that job, just the same as hunter-gatherers. Before we had kings and queens and politicians and prime ministers and, you know, a hierarchy, everybody did everything for the good of the whole. Horses are the same. And she says, if, you know, the person best suited for the job does the job. So in a herd of horses, one's a scout. So they might be good at noticing things in a distance. So they're in the front, you know, the one who's can be more assertive is probably the protector, and they might be in the back, and you know, all these different roles. And she says, anytime there's conflict in a herd of horses, the conflict over is who is the best suited for this role for the safety and good of the whole. And so it's a whole perspective change when you look at it that way. And you, I mean, you intuitively picked up on that very early on in the piece. And Emily says, you know, if you have two horses who have an equal amount of, let's say, personal power, and they are both suited for a job, that's when you see the most conflict. You know, if you've got one that's got a lot of personal power and one that doesn't, but they're both suited for the job, but pretty soon one says, no, I can do this job. You need to find something else to do. But when there's two that have quite a bit of self-confidence and personal power and they're both suited for the job, that's when you see the conflict. And we tend to think they're trying to figure out who's the boss to rule over the rest of them, because that's how we view the world. But it's more about the conflict is actually good for the safety of the whole. And you, I mean, I just love the fact that you cottoned onto that very early on. Good job. Get a gold star for that.
And I think I caught on to it because I could really relate. And I was seeing Contessa and all the horses I've worked with ever since as an equal being, not as this animal that's, you know, forced to be in this primitive way that I can look down on, but in this way of like, no, I can totally relate to you as a sentient being, as someone who has challenges of feeling safe myself. And I do have, although I leaned heavily into some of the kind of people pleasing and limiting myself, I also have another side of me that has a tremendous amount of personal power. And so without having people in my life in certain times that could really show me that I was truly safe, I would never give them in my mind the respect of actually being an authority. So I remember being 2 years old and thinking, they don't know, they don't get it. And I'm going to, you know, even though I'm going to maybe do behaviors that are helping me stay safe, I don't actually trust them. I trust me. And so.
And you had that at a young age.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we've skipped over all the young stuff. No, but that's the important part. I mean, those are the stories I like to draw out of people on here, to where, you know, I basically did what I was told or what I thought I was supposed to be up till I was 50, I think. You know, having that at a young age, that's got to be interesting growing up and knowing you can't challenge that, but feel like it should be different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't trade that awareness for anything. I think it's what kept me out of a lot of freeze responses. I think it's what kept me putting one step in front of the other, even when I was having a lot of depression, even when I was having a lot of struggle, where I could still go inward, even if it was in a really quiet place, even if it was in that caged version of it, that person inside of me has been really strong my whole memory. And that's not necessarily, I mean, that's a good thing, but the awareness of that has not necessarily been a good thing, right? The reasons why that is have been very, very difficult. So not that my story is more challenging than others. There's absolutely many people who have had worse growing up experiences by far. And, you know, I think when we're in the face of a tremendous amount of adversity and unsafe circumstances, again, back to that what we were chatting about, when the people that you're supposed to trust, you cannot really trust, then you have some options. And I'm so relieved that one of my options that I chose was, well, then I guess I have to trust me if I can't trust you. Instead of, I'm going to give my power away to you. It's, yeah, my power is being leaked and I am feeling, you know, scared and all these things, but ultimately I'm not going to give it away.
Wow. So I totally got sidetracked there. Let's go back to Contessa here. So you, I love the fact that you were talking about the farrier and you said, well, I didn't really work with her feet. I was working on making her feel safe. And that, you know, I have so many people that contact me like, hey, I got this new horse and I can't pick a fitter. What do I do? And, you know, I tell them that, you know, a horse's sense of safety, part of it relies on the fact they could flee if they want to. So for them to stand on three legs and give you one leg, they have to feel safe. And if they don't feel safe, and then you're trying to pick that one leg up, they feel less safe than they did before because you're not reading the room. And, yes, once again, it seems like you intuitively knew that that's not where I start. That's what I want to achieve, but that's not the starting point. You seem like you're very intuitive. Okay, sorry. Continue on with Contessa.
My pleasure. So, I really wanted to have a relationship with her that was meaningful, where we could both feel safe. And learning how to do that was not smooth sailing by any means. But I loved it. Like, and I would only work with her for very short amounts of time, like 5, 10 minutes, 15 minutes every day. And I was lucky that in that time of my life, my only job was to be on the farm. And so I was able to make sure that that happened every day. I would look forward to it no matter how challenging it was, no matter how much I would go, I don't know what I'm doing and this isn't working and whatever. But it was just constantly learning and like, okay, that didn't work. So what if I do this? And what if I do this? And oh, I noticed that I'm getting really upset and I'm maybe starting to lose my temper on the inside, even if I'm not showing it on the outside. But she is noticing that. And she was just such a beautiful, honest mirror for me in that way, where she would give me these very honest responses. And I'm so grateful that she was not an easy horse to work with for my first horse, because she was able to be completely upfront and basically tell me to screw off if she needed to, even if I was approaching her in this way where it's like, oh, you know, like me, right? I want to be liked by you. And she goes, that's not what I need from you. That's not what's going to make me feel safe. And in fact, I don't want to spend any time with you at all. So bye. So she was helping me find that middle ground, and she was helping me learn to trust myself more, not just in the big life decisions, like, you know, choosing to leave Montreal and leave school, but in the smallest micro moments, can I listen to that little voice that says, if I angle my body this way, it could actually make a difference. If I listen to myself and notice that maybe I'm not in a very good place right now, can I honor that too? Have it be that and moment of like, yeah, I am struggling, and I can take a moment with that to help myself be okay with that so that I have access to the next moment where it's actually better. And so she was constantly training that in me. So she never became like really well-behaved with the farrier, but she went from being totally dangerous to not terrible, not too bad. We can deal with that. So part of my role was to be holding her for the farrier every time he'd come around. And then I would find ways to get out of other kinds of garden work so that I could stay there longer and pester him with questions. And I love learning. I really love learning, and horses, anything learning with them, I was completely, just thrilled. So having his willingness to share information with me was just so much fun. And after working with her for quite some time and spending time with this farrier, one day he offered me, he says, you know, if you ever want to learn how to do this, I'll teach you. I was like, ha, yeah, right. Okay, whatever. And then he left and he pulls out the driveway and I was like, oh crap, wait, come back. I really do want to do this. And it was one of those moments where I had to kind of catch up to the moment and catch up to what my body was actually saying was, hey, this is something that I could say yes to as well. And so I found a way and started an apprenticed with him for 2 years. And then we became business partners, and I've been a farrier for the last 15 years. I've worked with horses, thousands of horses in Ontario. And they've been truly my greatest teachers, because just like Contessa was trying to teach me at the very early stages, all the horses I've worked with are trying to teach me, and I'm doing my best to be a good student with them. And I think as a farrier, it can be really difficult because we do have a job to get done. And it's really actually to help the horse, but maybe the horse is in pain. Maybe they've had traumatic experiences with the farrier. Maybe they don't feel safe in their environment where they're living. Like, there's just so many reasons why it's difficult. Exactly what you were talking about. You lift their foot, you're taking away that sense of safety for them. So, you know, learning how to be safe myself and also help to create a sense of safety for them and that experience. I get to have a relationship with them. I see them more often than any other horse professional. So when I've made positive headway in my relationship with that horse and I see them again 4 or 6 weeks later, they absolutely remember that. They remember me years later. I sometimes have horses leave the country, leave the area, go to a different barn. I'll see them 5, 6 years later, 10 years later, and absolutely they remember, and they'll behave differently with me or whoever that person is, of course, because they have that felt sense and that sense of safety that they remember in the body. And we're the same. We're the same. So they just keep teaching me more and more about myself, how I'm showing up in the world, how I can do better in that. And ultimately, I do better in that when I learn how to show up for myself in better ways.
So that's kind of the beginning of the farrier part of your bio. What, you know, out of all the things you do now, what came next?
So I can't help it. I always have to share a little horse story because they are the transition moments in my life.
Please do.
So during my work as a farrier, I've had the pleasure of being introduced to many horse experiences, not just farrier work. I've had so many clients teach me riding lessons, and I've ridden in the first couple of years of my farrier work. I rode about 100 horses at all these different farms, just kind of soaking up these experiences to learn more and more about them, anything that was coming my way. And one of the clients who I had done some of this extracurricular horse time with, he had this horse who he had adopted or purchased, I guess, from the RCMP musical ride. And the RCMP musical ride in Canada is the RCMP. It's this part of the, you know, public safety personnel of Canada, kind of like CIA, or not CIA, sorry, FBI, I guess. I don't even know how to connect it, but, you know, they do all that stuff. So there's this ride that they have that's really for show, where they travel across Canada with all these Hanoverian horses. There's these big black horses. And honestly, it's a terrible environment for them. There's been news stories about it. The environment is, or at least at the time, was very abusive when she grew up. And so he purchased her from this auction, and it was a terrible thing. He went to pick her up, and she was rearing, striking, biting at the three officers just trying to put her halter on. And luckily, he said, just step away from the horse, and managed to get her on the trailer eventually and bring her home. Now, they had actually kicked her out of the ride. They had labeled her the witch. But of course, just like us, these are actually really healthy trauma responses. She was just responding appropriately to her environment of abuse. And unlike other responses, there's no good or bad in the hierarchy of them. But instead of flight or freeze, hers was fight. Very, very strongly fight. And so she came with so many warning labels when I first started doing her feet, because she had to be sedated for everything. She has so much scar tissue on the side where they put the injection for sedation.
I was going to say a bit of neck. Yeah.
And he said, I don't know what she's going to be like, but be careful. And I remember meeting her that first day, and I just felt like I really felt her in my heart. I really acknowledged her. I just took my time to say hello. And then she was perfect. She didn't move a muscle other than actually helping me. And it was a very nice relationship as a farrier, her and I. So for a couple of years, that's how I knew her. That's all I knew her as. And then the little stories that would go along. So of course she came a long way with this client, but also she was never really comfortable. She didn't want to be touched. She didn't want to be caught. She hated being in a stall. She hated having any kind of confinement, which is fair, but also part of her trauma experiences.
Right.
And he was going to move to Florida. His client was going to move away. And he said, you know what, Carmen, she's always really gotten along well with you. Any chance you'd want to take her on? And at this point, I'd been doing farrier work for 6 years, maybe. And I had been offered many horses, and I continued to be offered many horses. It's one of the perks and challenges of the job. People trust you. It's very humbling for them to offer their beautiful being. And at the same time, I have a conditioned response to say no, because I would be bankrupt so many times over.
Yeah.
And I was really hoping to be able to have our own farm one day. And that's a really hard thing to do financially. So I was bound and determined to not have the expenditure of caring for one of these incredible beings. Because I also knew myself, if I took one into our family, so to speak, it would not be for a time. It would be for life. So I said no, but I said, okay, well, maybe I can just work with her before she gets sold, just because it would be a great experience. I'd already had some of that time with the client, and she's the only horse that I hadn't worked with. So I ended up wanting to start at Liberty with her, because I really feel like that's the best place for me to start if I have the option. And he was very uncomfortable with that, because she had some tendencies that she, if she was loose in this area, she would charge people, and very intently so. And she's about 1,400 pounds. She's a very, very big horse. And I said, well, I'll put my professional hat on so I have the liability. And let's just see how it goes. And I went into the ring with Grace. Her name's Grace. And
of course it is.
Yeah. And I just didn't ask her to do anything. I just kind of did some breathing and energetically reached out at one point. And when I energetically reached out, kind of breathed into my heart and kind of sent a connection from my heart, inviting her to say hello. She was at the very far end. She acknowledged me, looked at me and said, oh, you want to be in a relationship, do you? And she charged. And she charged with everything she had. And as you know, Warwick, and maybe some of your listeners know too, when a big horse is running like that, the ground is shaking literally beneath your feet. But I knew, both from all my experiences that I've had with horses at that point, from my first horse teacher, Contessa, from all of these things in my personal life, I knew it was really a test, and she had no intention to be malicious. It was, I am such a powerful, huge-hearted being, and if I am going to have any kind of engagement in a relationship with you, I need to know exactly what you're made of. And so I just stayed really calm and brought my hands up, took a deep breath out and just said, whoa. And she almost played a little game of chicken for those last few strides. She picked up the pace a little bit to say, really, are you sure? And I just said, yeah, I'm sure. And she skidded to a stop inches from me. And it was like we had this instant moment of recognition of this deepest part of who we both were. And we just danced in the arena after that. She would do anything. She would follow me. She would trot with me. She would match my breathing. She would match everything. She was and is the most subtly tuned in being I have ever met. Most intuitive and wise. She's incredibly wise. And so after working with her, and then I ended up taking her for a ride and, you know, doing all this stuff. And it was just an experience with horses that I had never had before. I'd had amazing experiences. I had a lot of growth, but I'd never had a moment where all of that learning kind of came together in a way where also our energies were so matched and synced up. And so I went home that night and I spoke to my husband and Aquila. And I said to Aquila, I met this horse today, and I told them all about her, and I couldn't stop talking. And finally I talked myself around to say like, well, but you know, she's going to be for sale, and maybe the person will let me kind of vet the person who's going to be with her, because I just can't see her going to someone who's not going to really understand those like super subtleties of being really powerful, but also really gentle and really strong, but really kind. And like, she has to go to the right person. And I was getting so worried. And then I was like, but maybe we should just take her. So that's how Grace came into my life.
And you sold that well, didn't you? You didn't start out with the "we're going to take her." Like, I've got to find the right place for her. But even before that, you know, you passed the job interview.
Right.
And I don't know if you know who Brené, you know who Brené Brown is?
Love her.
You know, Brené Brown talks about don't shrink back, don't puff up, just hold your sacred space. And that charge was a test to see if you would shrink back or puff up. And I just want to give a caveat out to anybody out there, is that can go very wrong with the wrong horse. Most times it's not going to, if you can hold your sacred space just right. One of my favorite podcasts I've ever listened to was an episode of Tim Ferriss's podcast talking to a South African guy that has a safari. That are the, you know, they have a safari in South Africa. His name's Boyd Vaarty, and he's written a book called The Lion Tracker's Guide to Life. And in that podcast, Boyd Vaarty talks about what happens when you are challenged by a female lion. And there was this whole thing, and he says, as soon as she challenges you, he said, you are in an energetic dialogue with this lion. And what she's going to do, she's going to, and I might get this bit wrong, but, you know, she's going to flatten herself against the ground. She's going to snarl. She's going to wave her tail back and forth. And right there, you have to look her in the eye and be very grounded or whatever. And then she charges. And when she charges, you cannot run. Because if you do, she will attack you. But she doesn't want to attack you. She's just... she's asking, who are you? And he said, you have to, you know, like as she charges, you can't run at her. You can't run away. You just have to kind of hold your energy and hold your space. And right before she gets to, she will stop. And you have to hold the energy. And then her energy starts to wane. Her energy starts to go down. And your job is to follow her energy down. But you can't bring your energy down before she does, but you can't bring your energy down after she does. You have to bring it at the same time. And if you do that, then she'll leave. And this is with a wild animal. And he says it works every time. And so I imagine with a horse it probably works every time too. But you have to hold that right energy. You know, I would suggest if someone has a horse that charges at you when you show up or whatever, I would do it from outside the fence. I'd stand just far enough back from the fence where they can charge at you and not actually make contact with you, and then practice holding your energetic space there, because then if you do get it wrong, no one dies, sort of thing. But yeah, you survived the job interview, but yeah, you really Brené Brown that situation, and I really... You know, when you said, oh, this horse is really aggressive, okay, but then you walked in there and she was at the other end of the area, it's like, well, if she was aggressive, she would have met you at the gate and bit you on the face. You know what I mean? So people create stories about animals, but just right there, you said, I walked in and she was at the other end. If she was truly aggressive, as you walked in, she would have been mauling you on the ground, you know. So, yeah, a lot of stories we can come up with about horses. And something I try to get people to do when they I'm helping with their horses is have them change their story about what's going on.
That changes everything.
Yeah. And like, you didn't buy into the story of what you'd been told, but you also lived and breathed the story you actually believe, not the one you'd been told. Because if you believed the one you'd been told, there would have been a little rocking back, an internal sucking back, a little oh shit moment, and you probably would have got munched or run over or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. And my approach would have been so different with a different energy, with a different horse. So, you know, I'm again grateful for all the experiences that I've had to go through as a farrier to kind of attune. And I think we're really talking about attunement, right? Mm-hmm. In all the different ways to what is really going on beneath the story, beneath the fear, beneath all the things. What's really the energy here? And if her energy had been where a truly aggressive experience was about to take place, then I would have had a different approach on my end too. But kind of sensing into that. And that again comes back to how can we make room and space for that true experience that our body is having, not the one that's just because we have a story, not the one because we're afraid because we think we can't. But are we really listening to what our body is responding to in the present moment? And my body knew that this was right and this was okay and this would be safe for me. But yeah, don't try this at home. But
it's funny, you were telling me this horse is really wise, but I think you're really wise too. Like I'm ever since we started talking today, I'm like, oh, I'm vibing on this girl. I love it.
I'm so glad. Thanks, Warwick.
So you got that horse. So we're still a farrier. We still haven't got into the other stuff. What came next after that?
Well, it was in the connecting with Grace and becoming her human that it opened the door to all of this other stuff. Because yes, that moment with her was serene and magical and beautiful and so aligned and attuned. And after I passed the job interview, like you so perfectly put, then she could also start to show me the parts that needed help. And so there was a lot of growth that her and I both went through to not have it be a one-time experience, but have that be a consistent thing where it's not just with me either, where she can be feeling safer to be her whole self with other people and in other situations as well. So everything that happened, I mean, my partner and I, we found a farm in a super expedited way because she was this catalyst. Like I was boarding her at this other farm. I was like, I cannot do this. We have to be living together. And I know this was our dream for one day in the future, but like, we got to figure out how to make it happen now. And so she was the catalyst to making that happen, learning to work with her and, you know, doing deep dives on other kinds of material, having a little bit more courage to go into my own healing journey as well, so that I could show up for her in the way that she most deeply deserved. It was like I was working with this whole other caliber of horse compared to any other horse I'd had the pleasure of working with before. And so that meant that I had to go into this whole other caliber of learning. And that's what led me to go and study with Linda Kohanov in Arizona. And I became an advanced Epona Quest instructor with her. She was an amazing mentor. I'm so grateful to be able to share a lot of what she does in her work.
She's an amazing human. You know, I'd had her on the podcast, but never met her in real life. And she came to our podcast summit recently. And what a warm and genuine human being. She is absolutely lovely.
Yeah, I learned so much from her. So much. And I, of course, was applying it all to Grace and the other herd members who were starting to come and stay with us. And they're just as amazing in their own way. But I will keep talking about Grace because, again, she's really, I call her like the matriarch of the herd. She's the matriarch of the people and the horses. But had someone told me when we first started doing this work, when I first became an instructor, when I was first going through this epic growth and healing journey alongside her almost simultaneously, if someone had said to me she'd become my most rock solid partner in offering this kind of therapeutic and transformational work to others, I'd say, well, that's a really nice vision and I hope it happens, but I don't know,
because her responses with other people were still extremely heightened, she could have the occasional moment where that would still come out. She would still need to do some things to kind of test how safe she was in a new circumstance, or someone would just wear a certain hat or something that would remind her of her past. Mm-hmm. And I would never put someone in an unsafe position. But she did so many cycles of her own healing journey that truly, over the last 4 years, 5 years, she has become my most rock solid partner in this work to help others go on their journeys of growth and healing. I trust her more than any horse of the thousands of horses I've worked with. I trust her more than any of them. I would never do this because I think it's just plain stupid, but I know I could lie underneath her and she would keep me safe, not only from her own feet and her own self, but from anything else that was around. She's incredible. So that's why I want to start to answer your question with her, because she's just been this incredible catalyst to everything that we're doing right now. And she helped me have more confidence in myself, more courage to say yes to other things, say yes to things that were scary to invest in, say yes to things that, you know, even if it didn't look scary on the outside, I had this part of me that was doubting on the inside. And so she kept strengthening that little muscle, so to speak, in me to go see what progress we can make together. You can do that in other ways too. And so that's what led me to study with Linda. That's what led me to have other learning opportunities. I know you had Dr. Rebecca Bailey on the show as well. I'm so grateful that I was able to learn with her on multiple occasions, her and Linda, and then Rebecca on her own as well.
Another wonderful human being.
Another wonderful human. So I'm just all these amazing mentors and horse mentors that keep allowing this healing journey to continue in a way where I get to give back, and I get to give back to the horses that I'm working with, and I get to give back to the people. So we have Horse Sense North, and we work with people from all walks of life. Very often I'll be partnering with a mental health professional. Sometimes people are coming for individual sessions, more of like a coaching feel, but we do a lot of trauma recovery work. And so we actually created a program specifically for first responders, because back to my story from Dawson College, I wouldn't be alive today without them. And I've always thought about that, and I've always felt such gratitude for them in their roles with that. And we now have a program that's specifically for them that we've been able to run several times, finding funding here and there to make it not out of pocket for them. And that's some of my most joyous work, to be able to work with that population who, very similarly to Grace and Contessa, needs someone to be able to show up in that way that you're describing that Brene Brown talks about. Be able to really hold that sacred space and hold your ground without having anything to prove with power, but also being strong enough to go, I can actually hold and see who you are and your experience right now, because you are such a powerful being. And I think the powerful beings in this world sometimes need the most support, need the most acknowledgement of how, you know, how special it is when their heart shows up, and to feel safe enough to do that. So, I mean, we can talk about power, and that's a whole other conversation, but also one that I love the most, because how we choose to use our power, I think, not only impacts everything in our own life, but either helps or hurts the world at large.
Mm. I went to a thing a number of years ago called a men's emotional resilience retreat, but there was a guy there who was a first responder. He was a fireman. And the guy who ran the retreat, I actually have had him on the podcast, Joshua Winner, he was masterful at getting our stuff out. But he couldn't crack this guy. You know, there was just, I think he's seen so much stuff and just wasn't at the point at the time. Hopefully he's healed some since then, but he wouldn't let anybody in there, you know, and I was just thinking about how much there must be in there to not be able to let, you know, it was a 3.5 day thing. And, you know, the first night we all gathered round and, Joshua said, okay, we're going to start out. What we're going to do, we're going to go in the room, introduce yourself, and you're going to tell us something you're ashamed of that you've never told anybody in your entire life. And that was how we started out. And then when we did that, and he, Josh went first, you know, and then we went around like, who wants to go again? And it was really, really got to where we all had some skin in the game sort of thing, you know. So, and like I said, Josh was masterful at things over the whole weekend, but this one guy was very, very hard to crack, you know, crack that exterior because of all the, you know, all the things he's seen. So imagine it's very powerful work working with the first responders.
Very much so. And what you're describing, I think, is really relatable and common to many people who have had that kind of military or first responder or public safety personnel background. And that's why I'm so grateful I get to do this work with the horses, because it's not, I think that sometimes it's just not enough with humans alone, even with the best therapists or coaches or facilitators. We need that extra level of horsepower, so to speak, to lovingly and powerfully.
Grace will literally just walk in through the doorway. She hasn't done anything yet. She hasn't worked directly with anyone yet. And these people who, and not, this is not everyone's experience, of course, but it's happened to quite a few where, you know, for lots of reasons that they've never cried or haven't cried in a very, very long time, connected to safety, that super stoic hard shell, both personally and professionally, I'm sure, connected to safety. And then Grace comes walking on through and she just has to show up in the space, and her powerful being, her big, powerful heart, it's like it strips away the armor in an instant, and some people can't help but start sobbing. I don't mean just like a little bit of a tear, like full out sobs, and which can be very unnerving for them. Luckily, that's all turned out very well. And I think we can really support that experience because it's normal, right? When we have a big energy that feels so, it's leaning into that paradox that we don't get to taste very often, where it feels so powerful and so embracing with safety and kindness and love at the same time, that shakes us to our core in a good way, even if it can be destabilizing. Mm. So again, of course, this is not everyone's experience, but Grace does have a tendency to really skillfully, without trying to prove anything, without trying to shove anything in anyone's face, just by being exactly who she is, invite us to join her in that very authentic, vulnerable, and powerful space. And I think especially for people from that kind of first responder, military background, but many of us, perhaps even all of us, when we think about our journey of growth, when we think about our journey of healing and just being a human in this world, so often we give our power away, and we might think that in order to do the healing work or in order to grow, we need to be really only embracing that kind of softer side. But both can exist together, and we really need both to exist together. So Grace offers us that opportunity, and the horses and, you know, your podcast offer us this opportunity to lean into our whole selves in a way that maybe we never have before.
It sounds like some pretty powerful sort of moments. Getting back to that powerful word again. So when something like that happens, you know, I imagine you're very good at holding space about that. Do they often talk about it afterwards, or do they just understand that they just let go of some stuff that they've been holding on to for quite a while?
I think both are possible. And it depends on the comfort of the person. I'm very lucky to have some very skilled therapists and professionals who can work alongside me in that experience as well. But I think what the most important piece is again, going back to that sense of safety in everything we're doing. Can we create that sense of safety from the very moment someone drives onto the farm to the way we start to introduce ourselves and get to know each other, to the way that we're setting up that container with our clients. So, or people are getting to know kind of what the expectations are and the lay of the land and what to expect in the workshop or the program, this and that. And creating more and more of that connection with each other. So having that safety and connection be present. So by the time we're getting to that horse moment, there's already been some deposits into that, so to speak. So it can really help to allow the person to feel safe in that experience. And the horses. So it's so wonderful to have the horses be this symbol of the moment, as well as an actual partner too, really being there in their full selves too. But I think we as humans are a lot easier to talk about, and it's a lot easier to talk about our story in relation to the horse, in relation to what the horse is experiencing, and also to learn from the horse's story themselves. It's so impactful for people to hear about Grace's story, because she did come from a lot of that organizational sanctuary trauma, right? The place that was supposed to be her home, the place that was supposed to be her safe place, was not her safe place. And she had huge amounts of trauma, and she's come through it, and she continues to come through it. And she is not only doing the healing work, but she's able to be experiencing a lot of joy, and she's able to be experiencing a lot of connection and able to give back. And so I think when we hear her story, when we hear other people's stories, like when you have people on your show, where it's like, it is possible to come through. So when we're having those really hard moments, whether it's leaning on the horse experiences or the other people, or just having these collective experiences of it, we have hope that one day we can be free of this level of darkness, so that we can actually start to transform it into something really beautiful, not in a toxic positivity way, not in a rose-colored glasses way, where it's a both and situation, where it's really hard, it's really dark, and we can make space for the light too.
You introduced me to a term before that I hadn't heard before, which was the
Post-traumatic growth.
But then you just said something that sounds like it is a term that you use a lot. I don't think it was just conversational. You said sanctuary trauma. I've never heard that before. Mm. Is that a thing?
Yes.
So it refers to trauma from feeling unsafe in the one place you're supposed to feel safe.
Right.
You know what? I have had lots of therapists on the podcast and talked about lots of things, and I've never heard either of those two things, sanctuary trauma. I love that one. That says a lot in two words.
It sure does. And I think so many horses experience that. I mean, I don't know if mental health professionals would allow me to make that stretch or not, but I'm going to. Here it goes. I think that a lot of horses experience just that in their homes, whether we are intending to create that for them or not. And the same thing is true for people, whether we have family who are intending to create that sanctuary trauma for us or not, it is there for so many of us in big ways and little ways. So no wonder as a world, we have such a hard time, space of safety and connection. No wonder we have a hard time moving through the hard things, because we're ultimately functioning from this place of not trusting the places that should be the safest.
Mm. Which leads me to my next question about something else on your bio. It's quite interesting because it's the self-defense part, okay? You're a self-defense coach.
Yeah.
But your pattern of speech and the way you talk is quiet and timid. I wouldn't say timid, but it's on that end of the scale. And so, yeah, tell me, how does the person who talks like this end up being a self?
Well, I hope I don't talk quite like that.
I was doing my best to try to impersonate failing miserably at it. But yeah, tell me about the self-defense coach part. Where did that come from, and what was your background in, I guess there's some sort of martial art there? And
yeah, I love talking about this. So When I grew up in Montreal, one of the best things my father did for me was find a self-defense instructor and gave me private lessons with her. And her name is Helen Stranzel. And I had the absolute privilege and pleasure of being rigorously and punishingly schooled by her training. And so for 4 years, I had a bunch of lessons with her and training with her that stuck with me. Her voice and what I learned was so impactful. And it was really street fighting. So we would do some kickboxing, we'd do some grappling, but it was really about street fighting. So learning survival skills in the worst case scenarios.
I'm trying to consolidate your voice and street fighting.
Well, you know, I think a little bit kind of like Grace, you know, when we can be really powerful and also have nothing to prove.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but it's in there, as I believe it's in there for everyone. But I think this really speaks again to what is the most effective power. Are we going to be powerful? And I'll come back to self-defense in a second. It's all connected for me. But, you know, are we powerful from this place where we're kind of raging and where we're kind of letting everything come up and where our energy is rising to the top and we're kind of having this aggression aspect of it where it's almost up and over, like we're almost coming out and away from the ground and we're losing our ground, even though we're trying to be powerful, even though we're trying to be maybe even defending ourselves, versus the opposite, where we can get really grounded and really deeply in our power center. And we have so many more options and ability and skill and effectiveness from that place. And actually the quietest responses are sometimes the most powerful, right? Someone says something really crappy to you. Instead of trying to push back and defend, you silently look at them with a very sure self that they have absolutely no right to say that. That is way more intimidating to someone than trying to defend ourselves from that kind of higher energy place. So, all to say that the self-defense work has been part of all the things for me, whether it's the horse work, whether it's my own growth and healing, maybe even very much connected to that moment where I was in the classroom. Maybe I wouldn't have been able to get to that place of calming my body had I not been rigorously trained in this kind of street fighting where there's no rules, where there's no, you know, tapping out. It's really going until you can literally get up and run away. And Helen was just an expert at creating these scenarios with me, also working on a lot of the psychology behind it, working on a lot of the verbal. So practicing, you know, if you have an assailant who's approaching when you're not really sure, maybe at that point, but kind of having some verbal tools to work with that moment and have that be practicing. Are you familiar with the Pink Panther?
Yes.
This sounds random, but I'll make it make sense in a second. Okay. So, you know, the character Kato in the Pink Panther, his assistant who like surprise attacks him to keep him sharp.
Yeah.
So that was Helen. Okay. So Helen would surprise attack me on the regular during our sessions. I think I would just be like doing some skipping to get ready. And all of a sudden I'd have a rope around my neck. Like she would be training me in that kind of way. Or we'd be taking the elevator up together. And then she would pull out this fake knife to do some knife defense in the elevator. All of a sudden I thought we were just in this conversation where she's asking me about my day. And then all of a sudden I have to fight her off. Wow. Yeah. So it was like super intensive nervous system training. And I'm sure that that also connects to my horse time and, you know, talking about some of the intuition, because it was really strengthening a lot of my embodied intuition in this.
It all makes sense now. Why you passed the job interview with Grace.
Right. Yeah. And so, and during those four years of working with Helen, I needed it. I really needed it for my own wellness. Like it was my form of almost therapy and self-care, because I did have a tremendous amount of anger and I did have a tremendous amount of stress and sadness and feeling caged and all this stuff. But in my sessions with her, I could feel more myself, and my powerful side was really encouraged and demanded to come out with her. And I think it kept that spark alive in a time where it could have potentially gone out. So I'm so grateful for Helen in that.
Anyhow, many years go by, 17
Actually,
years,
can I interrupt?
In fact,
Sorry.
I think about, Sorry. Yeah, yeah.
Would you say before that, before working with Helen, that you were scared of your own power on some level?
In certain circumstances, yes. In other circumstances, no. I think when push came to shove, I knew it was there. And so I felt really confident in it and I embraced it when I absolutely had to use it. But kind of similar actually to what we're talking about with Head and Hands and like youth coming in. It's like I could only access it if I was at the most desperate moment. And that's when it didn't scare me anymore. And that's when I felt good about it. But if I wasn't at my most desperate, then it felt out of place.
Okay, sorry to interrupt. So let's skip ahead to whatever we're skipping ahead to here.
Thank you. Okay, so 17 years go by. Helen's words and the teachings and the experiences are literally popping into my head, probably daily in little moments here and there. And fast forward to last year, or a year and a half ago now, I guess. And we have this farm, we have this facility, we're doing all these programs and workshops and sessions with people and horses, and we have this arena. And I'm like, oh, wouldn't it be so cool if I could have a self-defense workshop here? Because I really want more people, women especially, but anyone, to be able to have that experience of feeling that sense of empowerment that comes from knowing that we can deal with the worst case scenario and have a really good chance of survival without a lot of training. Like there's some really excellent skills that we can develop very quickly that can really literally save our life. And how much taller and stronger would some of these people and women, especially in my life that I'm thinking of, how much would they benefit from being able to access this a little? And so I started daydreaming about it a little bit. And I was like, well, if there's anyone who would do that, it would be Helen, but I don't know where she is. We lost touch. I showed up one day at the gym when I was 16 and she was just gone and I didn't have her contact. I didn't have anything. I guess that's another story. It's not mine to tell, but she had left the gym and suddenly my relationship with her was over. And I was like, I wonder if I could find her. So I did some little internet sleuthing. I came across her information. I called her. She answered the phone. Who does that anymore? And it was such a gift in my life to be able to thank her first and foremost for the role that she played. And we just had such a lovely moment of conversation and connection. And then I said, hey, here's a seed to plant. Any chance you'd come up to the farm, drive 8 hours, or 8 hours from Montreal, and come and do this? And she said, yes. And she came out here. We had an amazing workshop where we worked together because she asked me to be her volunteer and I would be the demo person. So she's like, you know, you volunteered yourself to get beat up a little bit. I'm like, yeah, okay, fine. That's fair. So I did that with her and she was blown away by how much I retained. In fact, I think I use a lot of the concepts as far as like moving with energy instead of against it in my farrier work. And a lot of those concepts come up physically for me, not just mentally and emotionally. So I've been kind of practicing it in my mind and in other ways for all these years. And she was blown away by my retention. And so she said, look, I don't really do this anymore, but I really want to pass the torch. So do you want to do a training to become a trainer? And I said, yes. So one of those moments that another opportunity came and I'm grateful that I had the courage to say yes, which I had a lot of imposter syndrome and worry about, but it was a wonderful training experience. I also had a chance to work with her amazing colleague, Nick Drosos. He trains police. He trains all kinds of people all over the world. He's a really internationally recognized self-defense instructor as well. Helen was actually his trainer. And so I'm certified with both of them. And now I get to do that and offer that to others too.
Wow. Helen sounds like she's a kind of a fireball. What, do you know her background, how she ended up doing that sort of thing?
You know, that's her story. So I don't want to share too much because I'm sure that there's a lot of personal things, but I will say that she's also, a stunt woman she's just, and she was a bouncer. Her and Nick were both bouncers at some really intense clubs in Montreal.
Montreal can be a bad place.
She has her own personal story.
You know, I think every city can have its rough parts, but Montreal is, in some ways, it's really a safe city, and in some ways, it's pretty wild. So it just depends where you are.
I think I was watching some sort of a documentary on biker gangs in Montreal, and I kind of got that.
There's a lot of gangs.
I got the sense that there's probably some parts of Montreal that are somewhat scary.
Yes. And so she was working in some of those clubs, and her and Nick together. So they really have it pressure tested, what works and what doesn't. And I'm so grateful that I've had them as mentors as well to learn from. But I think, you know, regardless of whether or not we've had a physical altercation where we felt like our life was in danger, and I hope that we never do or will again. But I think self-defense is one of those things that, just kind of like martial arts, but in a little bit of a different way, we get to really feel safer again with ourselves. Comes back to that sense of safety. Like when we can take it to the worst case scenario and go, I still have ability in my life. I still have a strength in me, even in the worst possible potential moment or reality. Suddenly everything else seems a little easier.
Mm. Yeah, my, well, I have two, but my wife really got into the ice baths in the last year, and she got into them for health reasons, but what she didn't realize was the mental health and the resilience it's built into her that is palpable to her, you know. So yeah, I think those things that you, those challenging things that you voluntarily do kind of change who you are and your perception of yourself, which brings me to our questions that you've chosen. And I'm going to go out of order here just because it's on top of that. What's your relationship like with fear? I think I know.
I think a lot of the stories kind of talk about it, but if I could sum it up or try to, I would say that it's not something to fear, that it's okay to be afraid. It's not to say we shouldn't be afraid, but being afraid of being afraid, I think, is what can get us really stuck and in a much worse position.
Great answer. So you chose a question that, like, the relationship with fear question, almost everybody chooses that one, which kind of tells you a bit about the people having the podcast, but not many people have chosen the next one that you chose. What regret would you like to share with us, and what did you learn from that?
Yeah, I really wanted to pick something where it was a little bit more difficult for me to answer, a little bit more vulnerable, and I appreciate all your questions. They're amazing. Okay, so there was a moment where I was at a farm, and I was asked to judge a costume contest. It was for Halloween, and people, or maybe it was Christmas, I can't remember, it was some holiday, people had dressed up their horse and them for this costume contest. And I was asked to judge it out of the blue. Like, I was literally wearing my farrier chaps, this leather apron, and I was covered in, you know, manure and all this stuff. And I go out to the arena, and it was fun. It was happy, something for me to do. And I ended up feeling the peer pressure to give an answer, even though the person asking it, that was not their intention, I'm sure. But they came over and asked it with this kind of authoritative way that activated my nervous system. And I ended up...
Asking what?
Allowing that. Asking me if I knew who had won. Like, I was kind of scanning slowly to see what their costumes. And asking me, like, who did I pick? Who is the winner? And I let that moment take over. In such a split second, it wasn't a conscious in letting this take over, but as you know, these things in our body can shift so quickly. And I scanned, and I had this front of like, yeah, okay, I'll just pick, and I understand, and I can do this. But it was a mask that I was wearing. It was part of my self-protection of like, oh, I'm not good enough to do this. And I picked someone quickly, and I picked a person that had a great costume. It wasn't about that, but I went over. I missed the person who had done such a bang-up job and went above and beyond. And it was clear from the whole group that as soon as I said who had won, everyone knew who should have won, and that's not who did. And that was really on me. And as I've looked back on that moment, because it really sat heavy with me for a long time. And it sounds like such a small thing. It's just a costume contest, but it was a really big thing. And I did my best to create some reparations around it. I gave the person who should have won a little gift next time I was there and a little card to not to over explain, but just say, I'm working a lot on where this was coming from in me. And if you do want to know more, I'll share, but just to know, let you know that that moment was really my problem. And what I learned going deeper into that was that the person I actually skipped over reminded me the most of me. So it was just a moment that in the amount of effort that they put in the amount of enthusiasm they had, that true place in me that's joyful, that's powerful, that's excited about life. And part of me, my conscious mind just went, nope, can't handle that. That's scary because I just got activated into this moment of feeling like I wasn't good enough. So I'm going to pick someone quickly and actually subconsciously choose the one who's not like me because I'm trying to fit in. And that is a huge regret because not only am I now operating from a place of, you know, abandoning myself, but now I've harmed someone in the process. Yes, in a super tiny way, on the grand scheme of what's possible to have regrets about. And it's not to say I don't have regrets about other things, but I wanted to talk about this moment because I think it's in those super small experiences that we can abandon ourselves. And that adds up to a lot over time. It's like strengthening a muscle. We can strengthen a muscle to be able to show up authentically and vulnerably and healthily in this world, but we can also strengthen a different kind of muscle and strengthen the muscle that says, I don't matter. I'm not good enough. I'm not worthy. It's okay to abandon myself. It's okay to not believe my truth. And that's not the muscle that I want to strengthen. And it was just a really important moment for me to reinforce that I needed to keep doing my work so that I could keep showing up better for myself and for the world around me.
You have a superwoman level of self-awareness. Like, that's the thing that's the whole conversation. I've been trying to think, like, this lady is almost different than anybody I've ever spoken to. And I've been trying to put my finger on it. I think it just came to me right then that you are extremely self-aware without getting wrapped up in too much psychobabble about stuff. It's really cool. I was just thinking here, like, I got to get my wife to listen to this podcast. This is so cool. Next question, if you could spread a message throughout the world, one that people would listen to, what would that message be?
The message would be that we can be our whole selves, meaning that we can be powerful and kind at the same time. And we don't have to sacrifice one or the other to really walk our journey in this life. In fact, in order to walk our journey into who we're really meant to become, we need to embrace both. So can we really show up deeply in our heart? And can we also really embrace our inner strength as much as possible and keep building that like baby muscle, you know, little baby steps, baby repetitions. We don't have to get it all at once, but just knowing that those two things can and do exist at the same time and that we need them to.
I was just thinking while you're saying that, yes, you are the most self-aware person I've ever spoken to. Oh, and you're a street fighter. Yes. that was those two things right there. Okay. So what have you changed in the past 5 years? Something that may have changed the course of your life.
In the past 5 years, what changed the course of my life the most is having the opportunity to create a bridge between all these different parts of myself. And I think Horse Sense North and the work that I do with Horse Sense North, whether it be with first responders, whether it be with individuals who are coming with any kind of background, being able to combine my horse experience, combine my self-defense, whether I'm technically doing that or not, you know, it's just it's the process in the last 5 years of integration, integrating all these parts of who I am that felt like they had to live in these separate bubbles, and that it wasn't even safe to merge them, but actually realizing that the safest I could possibly be and the most fulfilled I could possibly be is learning how to integrate them to be all in one bubble, all in my whole self together. So it's not to say I have arrived at all. I think it's a constant learning journey. But I know that in the last 5 years and in the process of doing the work, it's been a tremendous gift to be able to really embody and live that a lot more.
You know, it's just thinking, you know, we're kind of coming towards the end of this podcast, and I was just thinking about how the, I kind of got lost there. I was thinking, how the hell did you come, how did I find you? And I think you actually reached out to me, didn't you? And I, the other day at the Journey on Podcast Summit, one of the mornings when I was, you know, talking before I introduced the first speaker, I said something like, you know, I think I was coming up with a story about how this next speaker came on the podcast. And I said, you know, sometimes other podcast guests recommend people, sometimes people recommend people, sometimes I come across people and like I ask them, and every once in a while someone emails me and says, I would be a good guest for your podcast. And I kind of jokingly said, they're never a good guest for the podcast. You reached out to me, and there's something about, we had a big conversation at the podcast summit the other day in the intuition discussion panel about how I've always thought I had no intuition, and they were all trying to convince me that I do. And I've been talking to you, I'm like, yeah, I think my intuition said I really need to have this person on the podcast. And I think you've proved it right. So good job, intuition. I don't have, I think I don't have. Okay, so.
Thank you for listening to it.
You're welcome. How do people find you, all your social medias and all that stuff? What do you get going on there?
Yeah, so I think that if people are wanting to really learn more about what it is that we do, our website's a great place, horsesensenorth.com. Of course, horsesensenorth.com. And then on most platforms, I can't even remember what it's called, but our little handle, there we go, is called @HorseSenseNorth. So I try to stay consistent. The only place I'm different is on LinkedIn. That's just Carmen Theobald. And we try to have a variety of content on our social media, some that's really connected to these messages that we're talking about, and some that are just for fun. My partner and I have a little bit of fun on there. He's great. He's a chef and caterer, and he does all the food for our programs, and he's just an incredible farmer with a crazy green thumb. And so there's a lot of him like explaining about food and just having a bit of a fun time. So if anyone wants to check that out, and because it got some behind the scenes as well as some of the horse sense, hope you'll check us out.
Wow, that's cool. So are you on Facebook at Horse Sense North?
Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and we have YouTube as well, but it's very limited on YouTube.
Yeah, but they're all at horsesense.com.
At Horse Sense North.
At Horse Sense North,
sorry. Horse Sense North, yeah.
And the website's the only one that's not?
The website's the only one that's
not at.
That's not.
It's not.
Oh, correct, yes.
Is it the at symbol or is it at?
At symbol.
Oh, okay.
The handle. Yeah.
Perfect. Okay. Yeah. Handle. Got to understand all the lingo. Yeah.
Well, sorry.
It has been an absolute pleasure talking to you. You know, this is one of those podcasts I'm going to have to go back and listen to and listen to and listen to glean all the wisdom out of there. But the other thing I think I want to go back and listen to it is listen to how particular you are about answers and how particular you are about things you say. I just got this sense that you're very, very aware of a lot of things. And I think a lot of the stuff that you told us kind of illustrates that too. But I really love your pattern of speech and thoughtfulness in your answers. So I really appreciate that.
Means a lot, Warwick. Thank you.
Yeah, it's been fun.
And it was such a pleasure to be part of your beautiful podcast. I know you're touching so many people's lives and hearts, and I've definitely had a lot of joy from listening to other guests. So to be part of this community is such a gift.
Oh, well, welcome to the community, because you are definitely a part of the community now. So thank you so much for joining me. And for you guys at home, thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you on the next episode of the Journey On Podcast.
Thanks for being a part of the Journey On Podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick has over 850 full-length training videos on his online video library at videos.warwickschiller.com. Be sure to follow Warwick on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram to see his latest training advice and insights.